This is Speaking of Shakespeare, conversations about things Shakespearean. I'm Thomas Dabbs, broadcasting from Aoyama Gakuin University in central Tokyo. If you are joining us on YouTube, you should know that this program is also available on your favorite podcast platform. This talk is with Diana Henderson, Arthur J. Connor, Professor of Literature at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We will begin by talking about Diana's recent scholarly and editorial work in digital humanities and also on Shakespeare and adaptation. She also works as a dramaturge and theater consultant, and during her career has contributed abundantly as a scholar and administrator to the areas of digital pedagogy, media studies, Elizabethan poetry, and women's studies. This series has been maintained with support from the Aoyama Gakuin Institute of the Humanities and also with a generous grant from the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. Diana, your superb work is broad-based and difficult to pin down with a few key words, but I'll try. You have a strong interest in digital technology and Shakespeare, and this includes an interest in technology itself, the tech itself, and then how new tech might be rotated into teaching Shakespeare and also in how tech and media, to quote from one of your past titles, reshape Shakespeare across time and media. This interest overlaps with your recent editorial contributions and critical insights concerning theories of adaptation and reception as Shakespeare travels across hundreds of years from London and a much smaller England to different media platforms and to so many different cultures across the globe. You also work as a dramaturge and a theater consultant, and your early and still highly pertinent work on Elizabethan poetry and women's writing reveals your early and continuing interest in what we might call straight-up literary analysis. We'll try to get to as much of this as we can, but I understand from our recent email exchanges that you've begun a sabbatical as a fellow at Balliol College, Oxford. And may we ask about how that is going and maybe something about your current research goals?
Well, first, thank you, Tom. It's just a treat to talk to you. I've enjoyed your other podcasts and learned much from them. I'm here in Balliol through an MIT Balliol exchange, a fellowship that is ongoing and is a real benefit to a lot of us in the humanities, especially at MIT, to come over and be in a very different kind of institution, to have such a vital and a diverse early modern community here of scholars from whom I can learn, and just to step away from one kind of educational system, one kind of institution, especially at MIT, very focused on the future. I am stepping back in time a bit, getting more of those layers of history, which of course are part of our work in the early modern field. So in itself, just being here is a real delight for me. And that's before we get into the resources and the human resources, especially, which are so crucial in my work. All through, it's always been true that I've been interested in performance as well as literary criticism. And performance doesn't take place solo, even if it's a one-person show. And so I've always benefited, perhaps unlike some of my more introverted colleagues, I really learned through community and interaction. Plus, in the last 20 years or so, because I'm at MIT and have become more interested in technologies and transfer of the early modern, especially Shakespeare, across media, I'm interested in other people who are trying to bridge the seeming gaps between digital innovation, forward-looking thinking, and a long history of conservation, as it were, of holding on to what is of value in the past, how we evaluate what is valuable, how therefore we're making very pragmatic decisions right now of what to transfer to new media, and how to sustain those programs, but more generally the humanities, in the 21st century, which is not a time, as we all know, that has shown great interest in expansion institutionally of our deep scholarship in the early modern fields. So with all those things in mind, I'm here, I'm meeting with people at Balliol, such as Adam Smith, done wonderful work on history of the book. People like the Bodley librarian, Richard Ovenden, who's doing very interesting work on sustainable programs in the digital realm, and trying to link that with the folks right up the street, as it were, that is Shakespeare Institute in Stratford, and friends in London as well, working at the intersection of text and performance, new and old media.
Yeah, what an exciting time, and how many, the vast resources you have within easy walking distance, and then also just up the road and just down the road, you know, there's bus connects to London and all of that activity. What a wonderful opportunity. And let's get one question out of the way, because I think some people, well, many of our viewers and listeners, this is an international program, and a number of whom are from higher education systems where the sciences are safely sheltered institutionally from the humanities. But may I ask you to explain to us why it is that English literature or any humanities subject is valued and taught at MIT?
Yes, absolutely. And it is a distinction not only between higher education outside the U.S., most programs, and the U.S. generally, and then more specifically between MIT and other institutes of technology. So there are two layers to this. One is, of course, the U.S. system does not specialize as early as most higher education systems do. We do not admit people, anyone at MIT, into a particular major or program. We welcome to the institute as a whole. That means general education has a major role to play in helping students to decide during their first year or so what they would like to specialize in. We have an extremely diverse, I'd say, a true liberal arts range of general education requirements for our students. They're called the general institute requirements, and they include about the same number of classes in the sciences and in the humanities, arts, and social sciences, with the notion that these different disciplines, these different approaches to knowledge, are all working together, all complex problems. And part of our mission at MIT is to address thorny, complex problems to make the world better. We often succeed, and sometimes we run into roadblocks. And some of those roadblocks are our lack of understanding. So if we are only teaching our students to see a problem through a technical lens, they often miss the historical, the cultural, the human dimensions that are usually more a factor in blocking progress than anything else is. It's not usually, can you make it? It's, can you fund it? Can you persuade people this is a good thing? Have you thought about the unintended consequences? What can you learn from history? What can you learn through communication skills? What can you learn from all these people in the long march of history that have come before you, and therefore remind you there will be, we hope, a march of history after you, and where do you fit your own ambitions, but also your humbleness into that picture? So with all that in mind, it's actually true that the humanities have always been seen as practical, not just theoretical, at MIT, like everything else. And so from the very beginning in the 1860s, when MIT began, the notion, and they certainly saw themselves in contradistinction to most higher education, including that other Ivy League school in the Cambridge, Boston area, as being very pragmatic. And so architecture was there from the start. If we're going to build things, that includes an artistic dimension, and languages. The acquisition of other languages was part of the curriculum. And then after the Second World War and the bomb, which, of course, MIT had participation in the development of nuclear weapons, there was a real thoughtful reconsideration. Have we done enough? Have we emphasized the human dimensions enough? And so ever since the Second World War, there's been an expansion in the 60s, another round of expansion of the kinds of learning in the humanities, arts, and social sciences. That does mean that these days I seldom can say what many places have is, you know, you must take an English literature class. There is no such requirement at MIT. Mm-hmm. What there is that a quarter of your undergraduate education will be in the humanities, arts, and social sciences, with a wide range of wonderful possibilities there. And so what we have found is that makes both happier students, in that while some may buckle at any requirements, and they do, as much they buckle at the notion of having to take physics as they do having to take a humanities class because it's a requirement.
Yeah.
But they have choices. They have choices and routes. And so we try to find an embracing, large, and of the moment definition of literature that allows them to explore and balance, but also to find intersections. And again, that's where my work on digital technologies is something that perhaps I would not have pursued had I stayed at other schools I've taught at, such as Middlebury College or Columbia University. It's because I'm at MIT that it seems so pressing to find that intersection of pedagogy with research.
Yeah, well, that segues very nicely into the next topic. Although, you know, yes, in terms of humanizing and helping or contributing to humanize the people who are in the STEM areas, there's so much overlap. However, when you get into analytical, certainly theoretical physics, but not even, you don't have to go that far. Anybody who's trying to innovate in well, let's say Silicon Valley style high-tech development and so forth, whether you're doing a generative pre-trained transformer or whatever, you have to think of user end. You have to think about human beings, or else you're going nowhere. All right, it's got to work and interact with humans much more than, it's not just building a bridge now, right? It's gotten very close to us recently. Now, you have two editions, and I want to start with one because we have a forthcoming Shakespeare Association of America seminar, which we're in, on Shakespeare and AI. And I don't think we have to talk too much about that now because I'm not quite sure yet what I'm going to say. I did present, didn't make a paper, but I commented, the first sentence was, I don't know if this is going to be obsolete before it even, you know, lands. But but I do want to talk about your recent edition on pedagogy. And that's just something that is of immediate importance, particularly over the past 5 years when we all had to pivot. I've been a computer geek for a lot longer than 5 years, but wow, all the stuff that, including the platform we're on now. So this is absolutely kind of, this is hot stuff. How we can use this, and we're finding newer and newer ways. This title is Shakespeare and Digital Pedagogy, and you're also doing some other works with EdX, MITx, and of course I'd like to talk a little bit too about the Global Shakespeares at MIT in education, and also the platform, the wonderful platform that's been developed there for the preservation, as you were talking about earlier, of at least what we can get digitally with Shakespeare. Could you tell us a little bit about that edition and other things that are going on at MIT in terms of digital pedagogy and digital humanities?
Sure, I'd love to. And in one sense, all the different parts you just talked about are linked. First off, I came to MIT in the mid-90s, and my head of department, but also my dear senior colleague, Peter Donaldson, was a real trailblazer in thinking about how we could adapt and adopt digital resources of all sorts, the internet onward, and went through some really interesting experimentation with now obsolete technologies. We got in the habit of knowing that things would change before your very eyes. And so you have to really be thinking a little more capaciously than just what do I want to do with this machine? And certainly he began with things like the SHAED, the Shakespeare Electronic Archive, which now is open access. It was not for many years because of working with copyright, the whole attitude of libraries, as well as presses, some presses, has changed and been much more inclined towards making these resources available as what we should be doing as institutions of learning. So I had this great starting place to land and to be thinking about how can we then take some of this and adapt it really much more directly to our own classrooms and those of others, help others as well. So pedagogy was something that I know when you and I came up through graduate school, nobody really gave us training, nor was it really something you talked about much. Right. And even when we began talking about this as a volume, it was in the mid, around 2013, 14, 15, amidst a lot of the Shakespeare anniversary events, the Folger, for the first time, had a sort of small conference on pedagogy, undergraduate learning. Mm-hmm. And it was linked with some of the first folios going around the countryside and different groups in different states thinking about why they should have a folio come to visit and how they could use new resources as well as old. So that was the backdrop for this volume, which I co-edited, as I intend to co-edit pretty much everything else I do at this stage of my career, with someone of a, say, fresher generation and a different perspective. I think that's part of our obligation as the sort of now older generation in the field. Kyle Sebastian Vitale, who was at that point working at the Folger. So the two of us wanted to bring together some of this material and share it, some case studies, some examples that weren't too theoretical or intimidating for people out there who might want to just put a foot in the water, try one thing in their class to connect, not become early adopters, not necessarily, as you say, computer geeks, I'm not, but to, I've always believed in the teaching side of our job is really fundamental to who I am. So Kyle and I started thinking and shopping it around. And I'll say, how fast is this changing? I'd say in the last decade, since we started thinking about it to now, not only did the COVID, you know, the pandemic force us online and thinking about that. And now there's some backlash against that as a result, trying to move on, as some people put it. Nonetheless, it certainly was timely for us because before that, we had the volume and we were still seeing a traditional publishing industry to some extent saying, well, why aren't there more senior scholars in your volume? Why don't we have more name recognition? I'm going, because, you know, the people who are really innovating are tending to be those born digital, those who often are in precarious situations, whose jobs are not about having time to go to the library and the archives and spend wonderful times like I am now at you know, Balliol. They are just running for their lives to cobble together careers, and they are learning, though, so much in the process about teaching. So we wanted a mix of those perspectives, that we're all in this together and we can all learn no matter what kind of institution or what stage of career, what your name recognition is. People have a lot to offer one another if we work together and not become divided and fighting amongst ourselves. And I've found that possibly the most important work from my perspective to contribute to that group movement forward. So with that in mind, we put together these examples, and I'm always learning. There were early adopters in there. There were people who were teaching entire online classes well before some of us were forced into teaching online. And so there was real thoughtfulness. We didn't want to just be, let's react to the moment. But I can certainly tell you it made a difference, and it's going straight to paperback.
Yeah. Oh, there's just so much that came out of that. And, frankly, I'm not a Luddite at all, but I was so happy when we got back face to face. And there was a sort of shocking, it's sort of like when you, I don't know, after a flood or a hurricane or something, the landscape has changed. And these young people were coming back into class, and it just seemed absolutely overjoyed to be able to, to talk to each other. And at one point in the seminar, they just ran away from the topic. And I said, let them run. I enjoyed that so much. But what I retained with the learning management systems and so forth that we were gifted because of this, and access to, well, things like Google Classroom, but there are other ones, and the immediate access you had with students. If you forgot to say something in class, you could just come to your office and throw it up there, and they'd have it. And the ability to run streaming media over your projector, and it just took me off the blackboard completely, and I was sort of a diehard. I liked writing stuff up there, but now you can do this. And in my case, a second language case, I can put up our handouts and whatnot on and run it on Zoom and run the transcriptions, the closed captions, because my students very often, when they don't understand a word in English, can read. They're very good readers of English. And most of them understand just fine, but it's a very helpful learning tool to have, and that's AI, and that's extraordinary what it can do. It's not quite good enough in translation yet to trust, but it will get there. It'll get there, and it's getting there as we speak. I think that this edition, everybody should consult it. What I found from, browsing through and reading articles is that, yeah, there's lots of good ideas, but a lot of these ideas are so transferable to other things that you may want to do, because you have the basic platform. You go, oh, they're doing this, and in my class, I could do that, right? And just what a valuable addition to have. Well, there's so much here. I want to move on. Let's go to adaptation, because I'm hungry to hear you speak about adaptation and adaptation theory. And I'm just exposed myself to that edition and so forth. A vexed area is some, the talk about it. But, it's the type of stuff we love, maybe our nerdy side or whatnot. What is an adaptation? Or, is when... it was the question I'm grappling with now with the student thesis. You want to think about an original Shakespeare, but then it all kind of falls apart when you begin looking more closely at it. So let's talk a little bit about that edition in at Shakespeare and adaptation, and what sort of things we could expect from articles there if we haven't read it already.
Okay, well, thank you. In a sense, segueing from thinking about digital pedagogies as an expansion of resources. Again, anyone who's been involved in media studies, and that is a link between these two volumes, knows that when you get new technologies, they don't just take away the old ones. I mean, this is just right. 101 media studies, that the older media becomes slotted into more particular audiences or uses, but you're expanding the variety of routes in that case towards learning, and in this case, towards comprehension of what Shakespeare means in the world over time and place. And again, and media changes. So adaptation for me is not my favorite word. Those who know my work will know I like collaboration, because again, it keeps people in the picture, just like teaching keeps, our pedagogy keeps the teacher and student relationship in the picture. It's not just having a tool, but it's having these different media these different collaborations lead to this wild expansion and change of how we know and define Shakespeare, how we come to Shakespeare. So that, for example, more students now come via, say, internet, different mashups, different adaptations, much in fact, not even film anymore, right? So from our generation, perhaps, for many, as many people as had seen a theater production live, more had seen something on television or in film, as among their first ways in, or again, many people in schools as well. But those things get combined, different media, different ways of knowing Shakespeare, and it does push it back, as you say, towards what is the thing we are adapting. You start challenging more and more as you see more variety of what people call Shakespeare or believe is their Shakespeare. And if you're trying to communicate with them, you need to know where they're coming from, what that thing is. Is it a thing? Is it a plural thing? So for me, talking about this volume, again, I was so pleased when I was first approached about it by Bloomsbury. It was, would you like to do this? And I said, I'm not solo. I cannot. This is too huge. And it indeed was only when Stephen O'Neill expressed interest that I thought, oh, well, now there's someone who complements some of my interests. Because again, I am not the person who was born digital. I come from a love of both text and performance. But by and large, theater performance is where I came from. And then adding film to that, and then we go from there. But Stephen really brings that expertise via YouTube, his first, really the groundbreaking book on Shakespeare and YouTube. Yeah. And that awareness that I'm sure he would tell you 10 years on, you know, you write a different book about Shakespeare and YouTube now. It's not the same field. So the things you were worried about with AI are so much, if we are trying to pin down something, this is not the field. This is a field of opening up. And so in trying to think of what is a right research handbook for that, we first of all told Bloomsbury, no, we're not going to do the timeline feature because there's no way. I mean, there's just too much diversity, too much. This is not a topic that lends itself to the usual forms of here's the research handbook. We certainly do provide, and thanks very much to Vanessa Corredera and Kavitam Mudan Finn for providing bibliography and resources. Yeah. But we know this is constantly changing. So in thinking about how to do that volume, one thing we thought about was we definitely wanted to start with a bang of really paying attention to Shakespeare himself as part of this flow of adaptation, that he was never a static thing. And that's where we asked Emma Smith who better to talk about Shakespeare himself as an adapter, and then move on, get the theorization of that from people like Douglas Lanier, who's been such a leader in thinking about different models of adaptation, and Julie Sanders. And then also, as the book goes on in different clusters, we really had to think about new directions. That was another part of the handbook design. And I really think Bloomsbury's onto something with both in our pedagogy volume and here, by trying to get us to think a little more across our own writing. Instead of just writing like collections of essays, let's think how it fits into the larger whole a little more. And so they wanted new directions at the end. And we decided the new directions needed to all be in some ways forms of intersection between creative work and critical work. Yeah. That is not, you know, I think that's so crucial. And in each case, also creative and critical work that addresses the big world level issues right now. So eco criticism and theater performance from Kate Brokaw and Paul Prescott. Varsha's got a beautiful piece in there in the film. But Preeti Taneja's novel, We That Are Young, thinking about what it is to write a King Lear adaptation as an Indian British person between cultures, the global Shakespeare's movements. And then thirdly, Annie Dorson, a theater practitioner, but of the most AI-like, who's used bots and everything else and loops in her theater work to really think, what are the new directions? So I think that combination of topics, but also critical and creative dialogue closer together, not any longer text versus performance, as Harry Berger polemically put it 40 years ago, really to bring these energies together in new ways.
There's so many issues out there. And of course, in the background, you and I remember this perhaps better. There has been, it still remains, I don't see as much of it, the notion of Shakespearean purity, the purist who holds to, okay, well, this is real Shakespeare, whereas this other stuff is not. And where you draw the line, I don't know. And gradually, over time, and this has been happening since really the 18th century or 17th, late 17th, rewriting the ending of Lear, because it's just too sad. And but more and more of you see things. Well, in the Ralph Fiennes' Coriolanus, which I think was a well done film. I enjoyed it, setting it in as kind of a balkanized setting. You're not quite sure, but I thought it worked. That was happening. But now we're getting a lot more, particularly as we're moving into India and across Asia. Of course, I'm in Japan, and just published an article with two Japanese scholars about media, anime, and so forth. And I still feel a little pushback. If somebody takes The Tempest, for instance, and turns it into anime and calls it Blast of Tempest and just does whatever they want with the story. But how can you say that they're not doing exactly what Shakespeare did with the same story, or and many others? Just brilliant. I want to know what you think of this notion. I'm struggling with it a bit. The kind of bad word, dirty word, is appropriation, right? But then there are times when it is appropriation and not exactly adaptation. And I see it in Japan, of course. When you move it way over there from to there from here, and make it culturally make sense to people who grew up in another culture, there is an appropriation. It's not disrespectful at all. It's not at the expense of anyone at all. But I'm wondering if we can still use that term.
Well, I think we can use all the terms. I mean, I've never been in the same way. I don't think there's just one Shakespeare definition, in a sense, one essence. I'm not an essentialist for the use of these words. I think there's a, I have always found continua much more useful, on a range of directions, how much you're trying to preserve which part of what you call Shakespeare, and adapt which part, appropriate which part. And that's why I think, collaboration with its negative political terminology in the 20th century seemed to me very useful. Because, for example, to go back to the name Tate rewriting the end of King Lear, there are layers of that. When I was brought up, all we did was laugh at it because it's not the right answer. It's not Shakespeare, it's named Tate. How dare he have that arrogance from our perspective, post-romantics, post-solitary genius? But of course, we know in some ways Tate is just doing the same thing that people were doing in the theater industry, that Shakespeare was part of. He was making it fit the moment. You add some bits to Spanish tragedy, the world did not fall apart. When those changes were made, and ditto with Shakespeare's works, the thing that interests me is, how do you get less judgmental about it? How do you make people open to the possibilities? Is not to say, at the end of the day, I'm not going to say Nahum Tate's is better, but it's interesting to put it in dialogue. It teaches you something about what for us might be the valuable part of why do we love tragedy so much? Why do we want such suffering? Is that because we, you know, are intrinsically mean, or is it because we're intrinsically safe that we aren't writing it during the exclusion of the Popish plot, as Nam Tate was, at a moment when it was extremely dangerous to be talking about killing kings, or you know, I mean, one has to think about why he's writing it that way. He had other plays that were not allowed to be published, so, you know, or performed, for sure. So thinking about it in its own time and place, and then thinking about ourselves, again, the same thing I was talking about at the beginning, a little humility as well as a little critical ability and innovation, it's true in the sciences, it's true for us too. And I think now we see the Nam Tate, or I see it when I was writing about it, as a symptom of what needed to be done at that time and place to do King Lear, and also what it spoke to in terms of their own aesthetics. What is probable? Mm-hmm. That's how Tate writes about it in the intro, and we may see it as utterly improbable to have Edgar and Cordelia become an item, and yet there is a kind of logic to it and a yeah. familiarity from massive numbers of narratives we enjoy. So there's a reason beyond just that Samuel Johnson didn't want to cry that much, that for 150 years until MacReady comes along, that is the version you went to the theater to see. But you could see a different version in your study, and that's what Coleridge wanted to see. He wanted to be there in his own imagination with the text and go there. And maybe Shelley would have loved to see the original, as we'd call it, Shakespeare, King Lear, or one of the two versions of the original Shakespeare, King Lear, because, you know, Shelley wanted to do away with the monarchy. So, you know, you have these different moments, these different use values. I find it still true. I'm not so wildly free form, and I think you were implying this with some of them. Should we use a different word? You know, I don't think there are no wrong answers. I don't think we give away our ability to say, no, that's not actually what Hamlet is doing there. But I do think we need much more space for the creative play. I think some people who have done excellent work on this question of what kind of adaptation is it? Should we use a different word? Should we just signal different dimensions? Because this is a multimedia form, always. Yeah. Many people may have only known it on the page as a print form, but we know from the get-go it's a multimedia form. Which dimensions of that multimedia form are you emphasizing? And Eileen Ingagno's piece in the adaptation volume is very much using the example of the ASIA archives, speaking of East Asian and really rich material there in their archive that Li Lan has anchored in Singapore for years.
Yeah.
They have used different theorists, South Asian and East Asian theories as well, about what counts as Asian. Is there an Asian Shakespeare? Of course, all these are generalizations. Yeah. And we're always moving between a particular version, a particular time and place, a particular culture. And there's such fascination in seeing that. But I also see why people need to generalize a little and sort of try to have larger categories so that they can make sense of what is otherwise as diverse as the world itself.
Yeah. Well, you and I'm not sure if this case, when I was in college, it was basically a choice between two big fat editions. And it was the Riverside, or it was David Bevington's, edition. And both of those were considered holy writ. And they were readers. You're supposed to sit down and read it. And I'm all for that, of course. But I fell in love with this whole business in the theater. It was the theater that drew me there. And I still feel some pushback from people who feel that the reading is prioritized the reading. When I get into textual scholarship a bit, and you see, well, there's these three versions of Hamlet, and you see that fabulous editor, Harold Jenkins did. You know, I do think it's good to have one solid edition. I also have the Ann Thompson. I look at all of them, but the thing is that was a bit of false consciousness even in our field, that there is this original solid thing there called Shakespeare. And I liked seeing it over the years break apart a bit and have these discussions about textual variants and then what to do on stage. And of course, you know, even as we're getting to film now, and I'm kind of cherry picking your many articles, basically selfishly for what interests me. But we are going to go toward Shakespeare in film. What my students respond to, they respond to, in many cases, have responded better to Zeffirelli's version of Romeo and Juliet than Baz Luhrmann's version, which was supposed to be directed at young people, right? And some of them just loved Baz Luhrmann. But the thing is that they feel that Zeffirelli is more authentic, but, you know, you know, there was no one that had ever, how many people had gone to Verona who saw the play, you know, and you have these, starts out with these kind of fops telling very English jokes or dirty jokes on the street. So you just have that problem with authenticity right there. And then Zeffirelli's very seemingly authentic version does a lot of changing, you know, and pull it out. But we have talked about the differences between the reading version or the theater version, and why there are all of these words there, because you have to put people in nature in Midsummer Night's Dream. And the film director, whether it's Hoffman or somebody else doing Midsummer Night's Dream, they get to show it to you. They get to show you the butterflies and everything. So they don't need quite as many words. But you have a wonderful article that I came across a couple of years back, more than a couple, about 4 years back, in the Shakespeare Sense, that Simon, edited by Simon Smith, who is just a brilliant scholar and critic. And the century stuff here, also there's in the big Venn diagram that we're growing, there's all of this overlap and everything we're talking about. But this is an article called Parted Eyes and Generation Gaps in 21st Century Perceptions of Screen Shakespeare. I'm interested in that, in you talking about that, because I read it. I actually reviewed the book very positively, you know, the two thumbs up and so forth. But tell us something about that, just to give us an example of some of your film criticism and media and so forth.
Yeah, so thank you. You know, picking up again where you began there, which is these two volumes of the collected Shakespeare, I think, again, this notion of looking across generations rather than our starting point being where we were first made aware is so helpful. And why I mentioned, say, Nahum Tate and MacCready, because when you said there are only two, well, I remember my mother's going to school at Chapel Hill before the war, that she, you know, it was Hardin Craig. That's who you had as your collected. Oh, yeah. So, you know, or Peter Alexander, again, the play of Shakespeare in the 50s, 60s. So, you know, we begin by assuming there was some static moment, and it's usually when we became conscious of the world. That's and right. So I, you know, the real challenge for good students, and that tends to be who's in academia, is people who enjoyed learning. We have this tension between holding on to where we began, which we love, and growing and continuing to learn. And it's often tempting just to want to stop time. So in the same way, I think with screen Shakespeare, you know, my parents were all about the Olivier, Henry V. And I, therefore, that's my first one. And I remember going to see the Branagh when it came out with my mom and brother. And you could tell we were sort of discombobulated because it wasn't our, and yet It was cool, we thought. I mean, again, at that moment, and then we get a whole generation of people saying, oh, no, it's not what it meant to be. And I, you know, I'm part of that critique as well as celebration. But the celebration, I think, absolutely, for each new generation's contribution. Yes, there's a loss, and yes, there's a gain. So even when you're mentioning how odd it is in one sense that some students might prefer the Zeffirelli to the Lerman, I have to remember that when I show them Shakespeare in Love now, they go, oh yeah, that's, you know, one of my mom's films. and so I have to remember, you know, how fast this all changes. So that what is less cool than what your mom thought was cool? So you get it a little further back and it becomes one just undifferentiated past. And I think for them, Zeffirelli fits into that undifferentiated past. So when they watch also Brown as Much Ado, it's like, oh yeah, no, that's not adapting, because, and I go, well, actually, you know, it's citing the Magnificent Seven, and it's wearing 19th century, and it's in a Tuscan sort of pleasure world. Yeah, it's adaptation. But for them, that might as well be 16th century, 17th century. So I think there is a sense of what is distant, where are you coming from in that moment, that we always have to hold on to as we get many layers of history and moments. Similarly with screen, when I started working on that Concise Companion to Shakespeare on Screen, as I say in the beginning of that piece that you cite from Shakespeare and Sense, we really just talked about film and a little television. And we were all doing what is now called by many young people long form narrative, seeing the long form narrative Shakespeare as what was Shakespeare on screen. And of course, for those born digital and with YouTube past 2007, it's everything from the meme to the, you know, all the things we have in the Shakespearean adaptation volume play into that, fan studies and much more, spin-offs, slash, you know, you name it. And so thinking about what it means to watch on screen anymore, plus a world in which, and what I wanted to emphasize was the back and forth between different kinds of screens and theater, that there's not theater over here now and screens over there. As we all know, there was never theater without technology, but the technology's changed there too. And so we have a lot more intersection between use of video within theater performance, back to Peter Sellers and other experimental work. We, you know, beautiful work by many directors in the stage world, collapsing or distinguishing those different media. But the question of what is unmediated, there is no such thing. You're a character on a stage, you're mediated, right? You're not the person. And that is the AI link I think we'll be talking about a lot later this spring, for example, is what is a virtual person? And that links AI and character studies. So we know that many of these things are not totally different, these new screen uses from older ones, but there's a new energy and a new dynamic, and being open to that, I think, is really important. So that's why I wanted to spread it out, though I also wanted to get Sean Connery and what might seem obsolete or you know, old-fashioned works back, those screens back in dialogue, without just judging them to be inferior.
Oh yeah. Well, while I have you here, then I want to ask you a question, because you might have some influence actually in this regard. But I think you and I remember the old BBC series where they ambitiously decided to film productions, and they weren't quite there yet with the, well, they weren't digital productions, and they didn't know where to put the camera. Some of them are not that good, and it's not the actor's fault. It's just the fact that they were churning them out. Some of them are quite good that came out of that series. But somewhere during that time, of course, there was Ian McKellen's famous Macbeth, but they did Marlowe's Edward II. And It is wonderful. I have it right behind me on DVD. It's one of the great treasures. I got to make sure to find a way to somehow get it onto Google Drive. But the way they did it, you felt the sense of the stage as best as you could in a film version. Now, I like what people do. I love what Joel Cohen just did with Macbeth, right? It was just wonderful. But and of course, there's a bunch of other fabulous, just over the top great actors, but it's very watchable for, I think, even younger generation. And because you get a sense of the theater, and they do camera angles, they'll do close up, like of Piers Gaveston's first speech, which makes sure that the audience knows that he's completely corrupt or whatever. I wish, and it just breaks my heart, this happens a lot in Japan, that people feel that no, we are not going to do a recording of our production. This is theater, and we don't do that. And if we do that, we're keeping it. We're not, it's ours, it belongs to us. And when that happens, it just dies right there, right? And the memory of it dies when the last person who saw the play, I guess, passes away. So, do you have any feelings about this, that we should make more effort to preserve some of these theater productions for future generations?
Absolutely. That's such a huge and wonderful set of issues you're raising there.
Yeah, too, a lot.
It's a lot, and I was starting from my own experience of that McKellen Edward, which is I have the LP set of the recording, so I know it as an audio, not as the theatrical. I know the audio. And that's again a reminder that we come at these things with so many different ways and such value to a whole range of different ways in. And so when you say, what is being preserved, different things are preserved at different times. I think people in theater do have an understandable skepticism that if it's not a high budget, John Wyvern level RSC live multi-camera possibility, that it is not capturing enough of what went on. But there are these archives, and I've been working in them since the 90s, that do have some of it, some glimpse of it. And sometimes having the consciousness that you're not getting the whole thing is in fact truer to my mind than having the high tech version, because it's a different experience. As Wyvern himself would say, the online, multi-camera, yes, you're close up and it gives you an experience of theater, but it is not the theater. So the moment we though just acknowledge that and say, okay, we have different ways in, we have stills, we have playbills, we have all the things from the 19th century that we've been using for years for theater history, then we add on film clips, and then we get this issue, like something that seemed really exciting in its day, like Prospero's Books with its use of CGI, that my students now go, oh yeah, that's so old-fashioned. You go, well, no, but that was the first, use of the CGI within a film experience. So historicize it. Look at what you can get from that data. Yes, you're not going to go back in time and be there with Shakespeare either. You're not going to be able to make it absolutely seamlessly transparent across time and medium. But if you acknowledge that, yes, we should be doing as much conserving as possible. And I do think since I was working way back on True for the Times, actually, is when I was looking at all those different generations of film and screen versions, you find that it's not easy to predict which for a different moment will speak or not speak. So we need as much as we possibly can to hold on to that. What's changed, I think, is with the move to things like NT Live, RSC, as they realized they needed, in a way, after YouTube, they needed to have their own voice in how these materials were getting out to the public, because they're going to get out. Okay, so if you live in a world where you can pirate, where you have phones, where people are going to concerts and you say, don't take pictures, and yet, what do you do about that? So I think in the same way that places like the Folger and the Huntington, when we first were working with them for Shea, getting images, they wanted to have copyright control over that and you had to be password protected. That's gone because the libraries have realized, no, we need another way to get people in the door, into caring. And in the door is an is not is a metaphor at this point for the most part. Once they're there, let's talk about this, these different lenses, these different ways of seeing the material. But there are, even back when, I mean, there's the New York Performing Arts Library has one version of one performance of anything equity that you can go watch in a controlled space. And the RSC had that years ago. And I watched the Branagh and Adrian Nobles in that one shot camera work. It's not what he wanted to go out into the world, but you get something from those archives as well. So we're going back and forth between how do we get people in, where you want good materials of a good being always subjective, but that really draw people in. And on the other hand, you want to preserve as much as possible so that other people can discover. That takes money. I just want to say there's another reason behind all this and why I was mentioning the economics of it. For our Global Shakespeare's Archive, for example, I'm one of the things I'm here to do is to think about who has managed digital archives that are still going after, say, 5 years. Most digital humanities projects go for about 2 to 3 years. That's the normal shelf life. And it's either because of you can't upgrade it, you can't keep it up, new things come along and displace it. We need to be thinking really hard because, to be honest, all those old technologies I was mentioning that are so partial are much more preservable than our digital resources. So we really need to be thinking about these issues. I know that's not a simple answer, and I'm certainly among those who is trying to enrich our Global Shakespeare's Archive every day. But we have, there's a reason we have what we have there too. And I think people need to be aware of the principles behind different archives. So ours, the MIT Global Shakespeare's Archive, has prioritized not the National Theatre Live, not the RSC, not the big quote unquote traditional, you might say, in that they do the text in English. We've prioritized other parts of the world and other languages. We prioritized those who wish to bring their work to us. I mean, and that's partly pragmatic as well as not, because they are willing to share materials that we don't have the resources to go find. But that also means they're getting exposure. So it's doing something for them. So we have to find collaborations like that, which work. But I think it's equally important, and I've written about this, that we make it clear we're not making the judgment that this is the new archive of what is valuable. It cannot be encyclopedic. And often we underrepresent because the places themselves are underrepresented because they don't have the resources to send us films, say, or videos of what they're performing. So there are people who want to keep it all live because they are, they're true theater of the moment lovers. And I love that feeling too. But there are also people who are of the moment because they don't have the resources to get them out and share. And I'd love us to focus on what we can do pragmatically in the near term on that latter issue.
You brought up some issues here. I have 17 questions, but we have to move along to your work. But as a dramaturge and your consulting work, I did want to make a quick comment about it. It's been at the forefront of my mind recently about the difference between visual and audio experiences digitally. And this series goes visual, and it also goes on podcast. And I've heard, I know people like to watch it, but others like to work out or take a walk or cook. And that's kind of me. I like to put on my wireless earphones and listen to a podcast while I cook something, right? So, but let's move ahead because I want to get to this particular part. I'm just fascinated with what type of work, hearing about what type of work you might be or you are doing with various groups that you have listed here.
Well, at the moment, I'm working primarily with Karin Coonrod, who many people in the Shakespeare world might know already from several of her works about the texts and beheadings about Elizabeth the First. But probably most, well, and people in New York will know her work, some major productions in New York. Karin Coonrod is, she's the head of Columbari, the Compagnia di Columbari, who did the Merchant of Venice in the Venetian Ghetto in 2016 that got a lot of attention, and that I went with several of my students and colleagues and did filming of their performance, but also their preparation work and interviews. And that became major material that I used in the edX, which is now MITx. It's transferred off the edX platform when that was bought by 2U. So now it's back on the MITx nonprofit site. But we used a lot of Karin's production of Merchant of Venice, the one with the five different Shylocks. She wanted to complicate that narrative and that representation. So that's where I got working with her. But since then, we've also been talking. Well, she's working on right now a King Lear with seven actors. Quite fascinating. She's always got some Shakespeare there going on. But in addition to that, she's been working on a very interesting, so I would call it a chamber opera, about the ang well, it's the old English fragment of an epic Judith narrative in the same single manuscript as Beowulf, that often does not get talked about, but is, of course, the biblical story of Judith, then made into an old English. Then she's got it in a modern, with a bard figure as an intercessionary across these time periods and languages. So I think it may be the only opera that's trying to do Old English at the moment, mixed with
No,
modern English.
it's Judith and Holofernes, and I should have come across, we sh should in the apocryphal books, but we don't because that's not taught in Sunday school or whatnot. And that is, I studied Anglo-Saxon for a couple of semesters with a very fine professor. So much fun. I thought it was going to be terribly boring, and it wasn't. And we had to translate. And the story about Judith and Holofernes, we just had so much fun with because it's just awful, And of course, it's the Donatello painting of that. And, it just catches your imagination. Along with the other, well, anyhow, I won't go into that. But when you said
Well,
the,
and also the
yeah.
Artemisia Gentilesi. So there's a huge importance more recently of this sort of woman's reclaiming
Yeah.
and what it for Artemisia as an artist as well in that world to show that moment of the beheading.
Yeah. The, that's, some womanist narrative there. And it's one
Wild
of
stuff.
very, very few that I've seen in the Bible or throughout history, but it stands out along with several others. But this, let's move your earlier work, and I think you're still doing this. You've done administrative work in women's studies and so forth, and you've championed literary studies and, of course, alternative approaches to literature all of your career. And you started out with a book on Elizabethan sonnets and the transference, and you're already working on this as the younger version of you is already thinking about this transference from one form to another, from one venue. You're reading sonnets, you're sitting down and reading them, and then moving into dramatic poetry, which is a different thing. So that, and if you could tell us a little bit about that, because these are still current. These are current issues from your prior work, and also the how that works into women's writing.
Well, certainly, thank you. Again, you know, these interests are indeed longstanding, and they go right back to being an undergraduate and being interested both in the early modern, we didn't call it then that then, it was Renaissance, and in modernism and thinking about links. And that's when I was started working on a thesis on Virginia Woolf. But I was also studying Marlowe. So it was back and forth between these two periods that struck me as sort of the beginning and ends of modernity in a sort of text print model of literary studies. And I was interested in performance. And so the performative was always there to me in the in the early poetry, and it got erased in a sense, in the same way that when you were talking about the collected Shakespeare volumes with the rise of the editors in the 18th century into the 19th century notion of the bard, Shakespeare, that we kind of lost a lot in literature departments of that interaction with the performative. And for me, the place where that became also obvious was New Criticism, right? How we read poems in isolation on the page. And so I wanted to put these poems, which were a hugely popular form in their own moment. They were the new poetry form, right? As opposed to classical forms, the sonnet. Albeit Robert Stagg is now doing wonderful work on the complexity of the sonnet's history. Nonetheless, from the Elizabethan perspective, these were new vernacular art, you know, lyric forms. And to get us away from the notion that the lyric is only the sort of internal personal voice of the you know, the romantic genius. Now, other people, Arthur Muratti, were doing, the whole new historicist read was doing work in this dimension. I was coming along at a moment and looking at that, but also feeling a little discontent, even in the works of people I deeply respect, such as Richard McCoy, Richard Helgerson, that there was this drama being constructed which usually sympathized with the poor poet getting silenced by this female monarch. And I wanted to look back at that Elizabethan court culture a little differently. And so I wanted to see the variety of performative moves going on in this Petrarchan tradition that often just gets ossified or reduced to either Petrarchan or anti-Petrarchan. I wanted to look at how that was developing, because after all, what's really weird, if you step back far enough from the specialist knowledge, is that they created great poetic drama. I mean, it just doesn't happen every 10 years. Christopher Fry and T.S. Eliot tried it in the 20th century and it didn't exactly catch on. So there are cases, I mean, thank you, Carol Churchill, for putting some verse in Serious Money. But we're not seeing that kind of convergence. And I wanted to understand how what we had decided by the mid-20th century, we're on the one end of, again, a binary between lyric and drama, how those two worked together. And I guess my addition to just really wanting to think about that as performative was to put gender in the title of the book, but not in the title of my formalist dissertation, but we were only just getting the freedom to write about gender seriously as I was writing. And so by the time the book came out in the 90s, it was about that different set of possibilities towards gender that intersect with the move from a court culture and then also to the public stage. So looking from George Gascoigne through Peel, Arraignment of Paris, through Marlowe's Dido, Queen of Carthage, which at that point nobody was really talking that much about, and then on to Love's Labour's Lost, and seeing really what Shakespeare is doing as very much part of a talk back as well as talk with the Elizabethan court culture.
Those poems, anything written in that period, we know now because of so much research, was so in the world. Now, you know, all of the accusations of, you know, male dominance, the woman is ideal, you know, Madonna or whore, whatever, all of that is true. But you couldn't say that back when. You know, it was a lot harder to say things like that. There would be enormous pushback about, you know, this is great poetry. It's a well-wrought urn. It is. And I think Cleanth Brooks did a lot for literary, you know, the preservation of literary studies to our generation. But I was one of the ones who rebelled against that when I was young. And yet I had a chance to meet him at a conference, and he was so gracious and nice to, you know, poorly dressed, you know, poor graduate student me, you know, dragging in with $3 in my pocket or whatnot. He was such a gentleman that I can't find it in myself to dislike the man. But he and also very brilliant, extraordinarily brilliant.
Well, this is the thing. You need to humanize all the generations. I mean, what you just said, I can't imagine how probably rude and confident I was when Stephen Greenblatt gave a seminar on the Marlowe chapter in Self-Fashioning before it came out. And I was just very sure it was not right. And I was writing about Dido, Queen of Carthage, and I just, you know, and he's been very gracious ever since. So, yes, I think
it was transformation. For me,
that moment, Nancy Vickers had just really made an absolutely crucial contribution in what you're talking about, in advancing that conversation with her work on Park and poetry. But even there, I was sort of trying to negotiate between those two takes that you're rightly saying were the new stuff, you know, to read it through a feminist lens. I still was a little uncomfortable with simplifying it just into the blazon and the male dominance. So it's fun to try to synthesize what comes before and not just knock it off its pedestal and rebel against it. But I think we all need a little rebellion too.
Of course, of course. Well, we did an episode with Greenblatt, and I didn't know this, but of course, Penn Warren and Cleanth Brooks, you know, some of that old Vanderbilt crew, you know, you kind of associate with the Fugitives and so forth. Well, these genealogies in literary studies are just fascinating in their own right. You know, how they, I believe Gerald Graff was saying, listen, these guys talk about being ahistorical, but they are more historical than the new historicists. And so I don't know if he said that, but he's just saying these guys are historical. And I would like, maybe I'll try to do this, you know, just write a little, almost a bibliographical essay of this is what kind of A leads to B, it leads to C, because you can see the arc of history here. And the one thing I do, and we remember departments that were so male, just men. I do anyway,
I do too.
You know, in the South and then how quickly that changed and how wonderful that is. But these things should not be forgotten, because there were people out there who did work, who actually gave us a good paved road to go down, whether we like all the directions that road went in or not. Right. And I'm kind of hoping we're doing something to say, I know you are. Well, I think
I do think that, you know, there was a lot of labor in that change. And certainly I don't want to, I want to remember as well the hard work of paradigm shifting that went on, because certainly not only I, but many before me lost jobs in part because we did do feminist work before it was taken as seriously by those who evaluated it. And I know some younger people now feel some of their interests are not as valued by those who are established scholars. So I'm very conscious of those changes and the labor they took. So, you know, Linda Boos and other scholars, when I was let go, were so helpful to me to realize that almost everybody who was a first generation feminist Shakespearean lost one job before they got another, and I'm no exception. So I think that's important to make visible also to those who may feel struggling in the present, to have their voices taken as seriously as they feel they should be. And I think the march of history will confirm often that they should be. So it's important that we keep that energy going forward. Yeah.
Well, you see, that's part of the genealogy too, of literary studies. Yeah. And so much so much ground was gained in terms of personnel, in terms of what you now it's unthinkable to think that somebody would lose their job because they're looking at the cultural milieu of whatever and going, there's a lot of male dominance here. But that ground has been gained, and there's more ground out there to be gained. There's still well, I guess you'd call it illiberal holdouts thinking here and there, wherever you are in the world. I've kept you probably too long. It's just such a pleasure. I could do this, and I've said this several times with several guests, but I could do this. Just keep going. There's so many questions that I would like to hear your responses to, things that I've been thinking about. And I think we overlap a lot generationally, but I'm gonna close this out. I would like to ask you to stay a little bit after we stop recording and just to brief for a moment, and then I'll let you onward to, well, it's almost getting to be lunchtime. And so with me, we're well into my evening. I'm 9 hours ahead of you. So
Right.
the
Well, thank you for not only this conversation, but all the conversations you've been doing, because I do feel like sometimes I watched your being interviewed by Stephen, which again, I know that sometimes we find ourselves trying these new technologies, not, it's not what we started out thinking we're going to go do, but you've done a real service, because I think I find myself also listening to podcasts, like not just the tutors. I'm very grateful for how we can expand the ways we publish and share our knowledge in this new world. So thank you for that contribution.
Coming from you, Diana, that means quite a lot, and I really mean it. But I'll tell you this, that my colleagues here in Japan, our international audience, and of course, we have a large North American audience, and in the UK, well, I wouldn't call it large, but in terms of us, the largest contingent is North America, because there's just so many more people there, but we just absolutely appreciate you coming on and doing this, and just wish you the best and the happiest kind of sabbatical. And I'm certain that's exactly what it would be. So thank you so much again.
Thank you.